Hello, and welcome to Profiles, a program that introduces to WFIU listeners interesting people from Indiana, the United States, and the world. I'm Owen Johnson. On this occasion, our guest is the man who makes connections, James Burke, the TV documentary maker and author. He has fascinated millions of viewers and readers with his TV documentaries and books about the process of invention and the results of technological advances. James, welcome to Profiles.
Thank you very much for having me.
One of the nice things about visiting with someone renowned for a documentary series called Connections is that we can pursue connections in the course of the interview. So let's go way back. How does the son of a businessman get into the knowledge business?
Wow. Well, I began life as a medievalist at Oxford, and then I did an exchange with Bologna University. And after 1 minute in Italy, I decided never to go back to England because going to Italy is like dying and going to heaven.
But how did you get to Italy? I mean, why did you choose Italy?
A job. Job came up. You know, you take the job. In fact, I was in a phone booth in the college because in those days you didn't have things like emails and so on. And I was phoning in response to an offer from a Greek university. And somebody banged on the door and said, "Hold the phone. There's a job come up in Bologna." And I just said, "Excuse me," and put the phone down and went to Bologna. Anyway, so after a while in Bologna, teaching late Old English studies to very bored Italian graduates, I got pretty bored too and went from there into various other things. I worked as an editor on an Encyclopedia of World Art. I worked for 5 years on an Italian English dictionary. I translated a great deal, and I ran two language institutes, one in Rome and one in Bologna. And after a while, that got boring too, so somebody came in one day and said, "There's an ad in the newspaper. The British television company is looking for somebody to produce television programs in the Mediterranean for them." And I said, "I don't know how to do that." And they said, "They don't know, you don't know." And as a kind of joke, I went along, got the job. And I stayed one step ahead of the sheriff till today, really. And within very little time, I found myself working for the BBC for a magazine format television program where you did items that never lasted more than about 5 minutes, and it was about science and technology. And the more I did about that, the more I worked on that program, the more I realized that this kind of shopfront 5 minute stuff was the worst possible way to talk about science and technology to the general public. It gave them the wrong idea. It peppered them with isolated, unrelated bits of data. And so that's really what moved me into trying to see if there was some kind of framework within which I could do some more connecting, which is why it ended up being called Connections the first time I did it. And there was a rather nice story about an academic, if I may, attached with that. When I come up with the idea, I came up with the idea because I found a footnote in a wonderful book called Medieval Technology and Social Change by a man who's now regrettably dead, who was the doyen of the field at UCLA. A wonderful man, then in his late 70s. And I phoned him, great trepidation as a young, you know, cub reporter, really. And I said, "Professor, I've read this footnote in one of your books, and I think it's an idea that I think I could parlay into a sort of synoptic view of the whole of science and history." And he said, "What do you want?" And I said, "Your permission." And he said, "I stole it, you steal it." And I said, "You stole it?" And he said something that has remained with me ever since. He said, "Young man, you don't believe we're born with ideas, do you?" And I've adopted that attitude ever since. But that's how I got into this business of what knowledge was about. It was really because the media, it seemed to me, was doing a disservice by presenting data in that disconnected way. And indeed, everything else was doing the same disservice. I mean, the educational system does it, blah, blah, blah. I mean, shall be, without going into boring detail. I think one of our great malaises is that that's how we think of knowledge.
In what way did your university education play into this? You have this medieval background. Perhaps I shouldn't refer to it as a medieval background. sounds somewhat conniving. But was there something about the way you were educated or about how you spent your time in Italy that contributed to your development?
I suppose two things, primary things. One was prior to Oxford. I went to one of those great schools in England, founded in 1542, the new grammar schools of the Renaissance to service the new capitalist economy by giving people who could read and write and do arithmetic. And it had grown into, and still is, as far as I know, a school with an immense tradition, academic tradition, and fantastic teaching staff. And they were the ones who excited me to want to know more than just what was in the book or just what was in the subject or the class that I was doing. In other words, to really, very from a very early stage, to look at the relevance of what I was learning. And that, I thought, was the greatest gift that they passed to me and to other people who were in their classes. So it wasn't really Oxford that did that to me. Oxford, I think, ended up, like I suppose universities are supposed to, by giving me the confidence to go on doing it and the tools with which to do it better. And then going to a foreign culture and immersing myself in it as a child, really. I mean, I deliberately did not go to lessons to learn Italian. I went to the bars and the movies and things and learned, I hoped, as a child would learn. So I found the sort of concatenation of the two cultures was also another thing. It kind of opened up an awareness that the world wasn't just the way we Brits saw it, and or indeed the way it was, somebody said in a book, that there were many, that one could go on learning forever about what things were about. It caused its minor problems. I mean, I learned the language as a child, and consequently I didn't learn Italian. I learned Bolognese because I was in Bologna, and I thought it was Italian. And when I went to Rome for the first time, everybody fell down with laughter and said, where did you learn to talk like that? Because, of course, the Bolognese dialect is extremely tight, very unlike Italian. If I could just do two sentences, the listeners will understand. Please. If you say, for example, I'll see you tomorrow in Italian, and then you say it in Bolognese, I'll do the two. Ci vediamo domani. Assavdrangmang. So, I mean, radically different. And I was talking assavdrangmang to people who were saying, what did you... But anyway, so I think those two influences were the ones that really did it.
Was there something about the Italy of the time when you arrived, because this would have been, the first half of the 1960s?
60s, yes, early 60s.
When many people still had memory of World War II, the tourists were beginning to come back, and then you had Vatican II.
Yes. Vatican II didn't do much for me, although, incidentally, I translated for the B'nai B'rith at Vatican II. I interpreted for them, curiously, lapsed Protestant interpreting for the Jews at a Catholic conference. A story of my life, I suppose. But... no, I think probably because of this, my school. I had the old kind of classical education, and the classical subjects were immensely powerful part, basic part of our curriculum. And so before I went near Italy, I had, I was steeped in Latin, the Latin canon, really. So going to Italy was like going back in time to see all these things I'd been so excited about at school. I'll never forget the first time I saw the Colosseum. I mean, it just fell down because there it was, it was real. So that, and also, of course, the Renaissance was also another thing that had been pushed at school a great deal. So, going to Florence and seeing what was there too. So it was really, I was waiting for it to hit me. And I was one of the lucky ones. I got to go to Italy and it hit me, whereas many of the other guys I was at school with didn't go to Italy. And so it continued to be a dream, as it were.
One of your earlier pieces of broadcast work, maybe I shouldn't call it a piece of work, your kind of regular reporting was on the space race, particularly on the Apollo space flights.
Yes.
Do you have particular memories of that experience? Because in the U.S., we think of somebody like Frank McGee, who we associated with One Network's coverage.
Yes.
And we got up at 5 o'clock in the morning to watch launches and things like
yes.
that.
What do I remember? Well, I remember that I was conned into doing it. The chap who was running the program I was working for at the time, I came back from holiday and he said, what do you know about rockets? And I said, pointed one end, fire the other. And he said, no, don't joke. And I said, I'm not joking. And he said, then you're in deep doo-doo. You're going to be doing Apollo missions for the BBC. And I said, why did you do this to me? And he said, I went to a meeting at which I could not have been seen not to know who was the expert. So I told him he wrote the book. And I said, why? And he said, because you can read the book between now and then. And like all reporters, I mugged it up. So that's the first memory. The second memory is, there's always a thing in your ear so that the control gallery can talk to you when you're on the set. And it was all live, of course, in those days. And I'll never forget, the camera came down from the side of the spacecraft on 11, and a voice shouted, because they always shouted in my ear, tell everybody what we're looking at. And I had to say, I have no idea what we're looking at because nobody's ever seen it before. But I think the black is sky and the white is earth. But this may turn out to be wrong. And it turned out to be right. So those are my memories. I don't have any great heroic memories. I mean, it was just too sweaty, all that live stuff, with things going wrong right and left. I mean, the other memory I have is, I think, on Apollo 12, one of the astronauts pointed the camera at the sun and broke it. And the voice in my ear said, "Is it broken?" And, of course, I was on camera live, so I imperceptibly nodded while carrying on talking to the public. And the voice said, "Oh, my God, will there be any more pictures?" And I imperceptibly shook my head while talking to the public, and the voice said, "Don't panic." So I went on talking, and it said, "I'm going to go to the channel controller and get us taken off the air. Don't panic," and disappeared. What seemed an eon later, a voice said, "The controller says 4 hours. You booked 4 hours. You fill. Repeat after me, our father," and disappeared and left me to it. So that was my other. That's probably the real strong memory of Apollo for me.
You mentioned having found the idea for the Connection series in a footnote, if you will.
Yes.
How did you then go about developing the series? How do you make connections?
Well, I suppose it's like Aristotle would have said. You know, you sort yourself a structure out. Why are you doing it? I said to myself. Well, I want to tell the public about, you know, how everything's linked to everything else. So the key thing is, since you've got money from the BBC fools for 10 hours of television, then you have to have 10 structures, and they have to have also one overall structure. So the first thing I did was work out, in an ideal world, what structure that would be. And if it were connective, as I hoped it would be, then obviously one would start somewhere and travel through connections to somewhere else. Then why would you have a second program? Because there would be a raison d'etre for finishing where you did in the first program and starting where you did in the second. And that became the guiding principle that you know, having finished with something, I then in the next program went back to something relevant to that in the past and came forward again, but to somewhere different, proving another point. You know, the pathways are not always the same. After that, well, it made itself. I mean, all I had to do was toss a coin and see where I'd start. Because the great thing about the principle is it always works. I mean, you know, everything is connected to everything else. And then the interesting thing becomes, what kind of technique do you use to keep the audience from switching off, yawning, getting bored, never watching again, you losing your job? And so one was always in the business of finding a cliffhanger. So every link was one, first of all, that would be entirely unexpected. So there would be nobody out there saying, "Oh, I know this." And then the second thing would be, not only would it be unexpected, but that each little two-minute, three-minute piece connection would end with something that would make you think you were going that way, but then you'd go this way. So it would be doubly unexpected. And I hope that that worked. And to a certain extent, it did, because I'm here talking to you now, and I wouldn't be if I'd been fired. So that was the basic approach.
Do you make a list of things and draw the connections? I guess the thing that sort of puzzles me, we have the kind of whole of human knowledge and experience.
Right. Yeah.
How do you pull things out of
it? Right. Well, I don't know how you do it. I mean, you read and read and read and read and read. I mean, I spent the great thing about the Beeb, you know, the BBC, is that those people would give you money to sit in a library for 2 years. And I kept thinking, any minute now, somebody's coming in and saying, "We know what you're doing and you can stop it right now." But they never did. So I spent a vast amount of time reading and looking for links, looking for and going down wrong pathways 1,000 times because it led you somewhere either boring or there was no exit point from it, because there always has to be an exit point to the next one. And then when you get to the end, that has to be valid in the modern world. And actually, the most interesting thing was the bridge in the middle. I found it, in general, what happened was that I would begin at the beginning of a program and write my way into, about 12 or 14 connections, working on the basis back then that the audience would like a change of subject about every 3 minutes. You knew that in 1 hour you had that many, you had 20 pieces. So about 10 or 11 pieces in, one would always hope to be somewhere like the 19th century where lots was going on. And then you'd think, now where would I like this to end? And you'd look in all sorts of ways and you'd think, maybe we could end there. So you would go there and come backwards and see if backward connections would take you anywhere near where you had ended up. You know, like building bridges from two sides of a river. And very often, of course, the two bits of the bridge did not come together, and finding a way to make them come together would make the program last 9 hours. So one rejected a vast amount. But inevitably, there was always There were several links that would have done the trick, and you were able to choose the most interesting or the most unexpected or the funniest one.
To what degree did you have to think visually, since it is television?
Oh, very. I mean...
Does that affect the links?
Oh, yes, yes. You would do a link that would be intellectually satisfying, and you'd think, this is really going to be dull visually, so you'd throw it away. The alternative, of course, was to say, well, it would be visually dull unless I thought of a very clever way to do it. So there was that added level at which you could say, well, I think we could do it this way and it will still surprise people, and they won't realize that they're being told something very dull until it's over, and then by that time we've moved on to the next bit. And that was probably the most interesting part of the exercise, really. And then when you'd got all the links and done all the bits, I used to find it very interesting to graph it out and do a graph saying, how dense is the material? How slow moving is the material? How amusing is it? How noisy is it? How exciting is it? How complicated is it? And you would generally find that all these lines would show that the bits you liked had everything, and the bits you didn't like very much had nothing at all. And then you'd have to go back again and restructure so that the line did not do that sine curve. You didn't have everything in the thing you loved and nothing at all in the thing you didn't like very much and were hurrying through, you know. So it was a very useful structural exercise as well.
Did you have to think about budget? Because a lot of your filming was done in various places around the world.
Yeah, no. The great thing about the BBC in those days, but not anymore, was they gave you the money you asked for, so you always asked for twice as much. The caveat being, we'll give you the money. If it fails, you'll be found head down in a well and you'll never work again. So, I mean, they gave you the rope and you hanged yourself. It's not like that anymore. So I really lived in a golden era for that.
What was your most memorable trip?
Oh, that's too difficult to say.
Name a couple.
Well, my most memorable moments, I was in Gullfoss, at a place called Gullfoss in Iceland, which is this vast cataract that goes down into a cavern below the earth. And it's just enormous. And we decided that I would stand on a ledge jutting out into it. And I stood on the ledge and did my piece and walked off the ledge, and a bit of the ledge fell. And I think that's probably my most memorable moment. And the second memorable moment, similar one really, I was in Antarctica. And the helicopter, the idea was going to be that the helicopter would come around an ice mountain, and there in the middle of nowhere there was this little dot, and the helicopter would crab in sideways, and finally this dot would reveal itself to be my back, and I'd turn around and say what I was going to say. So I got into the position. The helicopter went away. It didn't come back. Now, there are no phone booths. There are no roads. There are no villages. There are no bars. There's nothing. And after 20 minutes, I began to think, you know, I should have changed my career. And then the helicopter arrived, and we did the shot. And the chopper pilot, who was an American Marine, marvelous guy, well, we were there courtesy of the Americans. I said, where did you go? And he said, well, I came in on the same flight as you, and these ice mountains look all the same to me. He said, we've been looking for you for 20 minutes. So those are my two memories, both near death.
What do you bring to these programs that a professionally trained historian would not?
The fact that I'm not a professionally trained historian, I think, so that I think I bring a touch of the great unwashed. The most exciting thing for me in my career has been I have spent my entire career, except for when I was a medievalist, learning things I didn't know. And the BBC taught me that. They said, if you don't understand it, they won't understand it. And when I joined the BBC, I joined the new science division, which recruited only humanities graduates on the basis that if they understood science, anybody would. So you had to filter it down to your level. And, you know, I remember talking to Richard Feynman, great physicist, you know, who, alas, is dead. And I said, and I'm sorry, try it again. And he, because all great scientists are like that, he said, OK, kid, I'll do it again. And finally I said, is this what I should say? And he said, oh, well, he winced and said, I suppose that'll be OK. And that was an ongoing experience throughout my career, has been. So I think probably what I bring to it is what anybody would bring to it, ignorance. I think it's probably the most important thing.
If we turn the question around, is there something that you might feel that you lack because of not having had advanced training in history or technology?
No, I don't think so. I think it's very important not to have it. I mean, if I could just about recall my own field, You know, I would think probably the best way to approach it, if you were trying to be to divulge it to the public, would be from a point of ignorance. I think it would be much harder for me to talk about late Old English than it is to talk about quantum physics to the public, because I know too much. And the vocabulary and every other thing. I mean, the taxonomy is the big wall between you and them. So no, I don't.
It strikes me that you may have been at the BBC at the right time, because if you think back to what Lord Reith was saying in the 1920s and 30s about this was supposed to be high culture. And yet you make this reference to, we don't want a segment to go more than 2 or 3 minutes because people will get bored.
Well, yes and no. I mean, Reith said, I paraphrase him, he said, never ask the audience what it wants. Give it what you think it needs. Well, by the time I joined the BBC, the mantra wasn't that. It was, if it bores you, it'll probably bore them. So that's the touchstone. If what you're doing is boring or becomes boring, you can bet that it's going to bore them. So keep that in mind. So it was still an oligarchy. I mean, it was... When I went to the Beeb, it was full of Oxford and Cambridge. I don't think there was anybody from any other university. And it was very collegiate, but based on this premise that the most important thing to be was ignorant, and based on the fact that all of us were humanities graduates and we were dealing in science, so we were all in the same boat and it was sinking fast, you know. So it was a golden age in that sense, but I think we'd moved on a little bit from Reith.
Have you ever wondered about the technological dead ends, perhaps we could call them disconnects?
No, I don't think I have. I haven't really found the time to wonder about things. I just get on with the next thing I'm going to do. I think wondering about things like that is probably a good thing for an academic to do. It's a good kind of interesting career to have. No, I don't have time for that. I don't mean that in any supercilious way. It's just that I might make a program about it, but it's not as interesting. Because I think probably most of the dead ends I've bumped into have been dead ends for very good historical reasons. I mean, you know, that if you gave everybody a PhD in 2000 BC, who would have built the pyramids? You know, so there are usually good historical reasons for the culture of scarcity having expressed itself the way it has.
Would you have ever been in a situation where you would have wanted to redo the connections? Let me just kind of throw out an example. Mm. Elizabeth Eisenstein wrote a book in 1979 about the impact of printing, and then historians came along over the next 10, 15, 20 years and said, no, you don't really have it right.
Yes, I know. I remember that was that was a seminal book for me way back. Yes, of course. I mean, if I had to do again, I'd do it entirely differently. But that, in a way, by definition, is what it's about. I mean, if I did it again, I'm a different person. The world has changed. We know more things. And the one thing you learn about history is that they weren't wrong. They were just in their context. And so was I. So 30, 40 years ago, I made a program that was right for its time. It continually amazes me that anybody bothers to watch it anymore.
So with this Connections program, you became famous, kind of household name, if you will. Mm. Wikipedia has even dug up references to you in a couple places in popular culture.
Yes.
What has that fame done to you?
I hope nothing. I'm married to a woman who nails my feet to the ground. So it hasn't done any of those things to me. And also, fame in Britain isn't the same as fame here. There's no adulation. The British walk past you and you get a quick sideways flick of the eyes. That's all you get. Nobody comes up to you and says, I like or hate your work. No, nobody. I mean, people kind of studiously ignore you. Now and again, you get a table at a restaurant. But my wife usually books the tables, and she doesn't say that. Her name is Hamilton, and she could say she was Lady Hamilton.
I don't think you want to go too far with
indeed,
that.
Indeed, indeed. Yeah, but so no, I don't think fame doesn't mean anything in England anyway. I don't care about it if it did do anything, and it's fleeting. I mean, it's going already. I mean, I haven't made a television program for about 5 years, and already people are saying who, you know.
Many of your television programs have become books. Which do you find most interesting, the books or the documentaries?
The books, of course, yeah. I mean, I love writing. And going back to one of the earlier things we were discussing, the great thing about a book is you don't have to worry about the pictures. You know, you create the pictures as you write, so you can create any picture that's required. You know, you're not stuck with Angkor Wat, and it looks like that, whether you like it or not, and it ain't, you know, the Eiffel Tower. So there's fantastic freedom in the writing that I like enormously. I'm happiest is sitting in the library getting ready, right, you know, researching it. And the longer the better. The thing I'm working on now, I think, is probably going to take about 5 years. And I'm really looking forward to 5 years grinding away.
We'll come back to that in a minute, but let's take a break for some music. You've picked Recuerdo de la Alhambra by Francisco Torrega.
Yes.
How did you come to know this music, and what does it mean to you?
Well, it's very simple. I've played classical guitar very badly for 45 years. And because I'm busy, I don't get as much time to practice. About every 5 years, I can play it. Right now, I'm at the other end of the curve. So it'll be another 2.5 years before I get the chance to practice enough to go back and play it again. But it's my touchstone musically. And I like the piece anyway. And so that's why I like it.
Was Recuerdos de la Alhambra by Francisco Torrega, music chosen by our guest on Profiles today, James Burke, the television documentarian and writer. You're listening to Profiles on WFIU.
Support comes from Smithville, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922, with residential and business internet, voice, and security services. Smithville, local pride, global technology. Information at smithville.net.
We'll come back to your present program or present activity in a bit, but let's look at a couple of other of the documentaries and research projects you've been involved with. One was The Real Thing, 6 parts, I think, examination of the brain. What led you to that subject?
Well, it was really a sort of examination of what reality was. And I don't know, the BBC, after I did Connections, the BBC said, well, now what do you want to do? And the great thing about the BBC is that they really forced, it's like imminent execution. Either you tell them or you don't get the money. And they said, tell us tomorrow. And I went home and I got desperate about it. And I thought, what is it? What do I do? What do I tell these people I want to do? And I suddenly realized that, as it were, a self, by definition, what I needed to do was to talk about what reality was, what the reality of this problem was. So I said, reality. And they said, fine, okay, here's the money. This was the wonderful thing about the BBC in those days. It didn't say, give us paragraphs and give us 12-page outline treatment. And I don't know, because it seemed a good idea at the time. As I keep on saying, one is in a context. And at the time, it just seemed like a good idea. It was proved by the audience figures that it was something about which people were interested. And it was better than real work. This is the great thing about my career. It's been better than real work all along. And so they gave me enough money to make 6 half-hour programs. And, I can't remember the exact structure, but it was something like one program was, how do you know what it is? And then how do you know where it is? And if you don't know what or where it is, how do you know it exists at all? And eventually I came down to the sophomoric answer, which is, of course, this is 30 years ago, that reality was probably language, that you probably structured reality through the use of language. And the thing I loved about that series, I did it with a very talented director called Mick Jackson, who went on to Hollywood and made amazing movies like Volcano, The Coast is Toast. And he's still there being terribly successful. And I had the great privilege of working with him. And he, and between us, it was a wonderful exercise. How do you do a program that says reality is language? And first of all, we did it in black and white. So that it was as printed on a page, and went from there. So it was a very exciting experience, delving and ending up, as I said, with this rather simple view of what reality might be.
How do you go about visualizing something like that?
Well, the final program which was in black and white, was set in a white space, what we call a cove in England. I don't know what it's called in American. It's a curved space, and you paint it white, and therefore there is no dimension, no nothing. And what was happening was in black and white. So the conceit, if you like, was that it was all happening on a page. I don't know. I don't remember the detail, because it's a long time ago, but I remember talking about the concept of cat. You know, the concept of cat doesn't mean cats, and it doesn't mean a cat. So what does it mean? And so we had lots of cats for a second or two, you know. And, but it's long ago when the wench is dead.
Another kind of interesting program, and perhaps ahead of its time, a 2-hour mini-documentary on the greenhouse effect.
Yeah, I knew you were going to say that, yes. It was ahead of its time because I got crucified for it by certain people, such to the extent that we had to put another program on called, it was called After the Warming, and we had to put another program on called After the Warming, where I was sitting in a studio and these people went for my jugular saying, there is no proof. I won't expatiate on who they were, but you can guess. That was a good program. I did that for PBS, not for the BBC. And again, that was in the days when PBS was like the BBC. It had enough money and you weren't going through a recession and so on. So it was a great pleasure to make that program. We like to think we predicted the Gulf excitement. I mean, before you guys went into Iraq for the first or second time. The only thing I got wrong was that I predicted a planetary authority on the subject by 2000. This has been 1988. And of course, I was woefully wrong. It has taken the politicians much longer than that not to get there.
How did you decide that that was the time to do the program?
Because it was an issue that needed discussing. And it wasn't being discussed by the media, but it was being discussed sort of samizdat-wise. It was being discussed, you know, in if you read the right papers. It just seemed like, again, it's part of I suppose, part of one's raison d'etre in television doing what I do is always to be ahead of the curve. I don't mean that in the kind of Madison Avenue sense, but that you've got the money, you've got the facilities, you've got the capabilities, you're allowed to do it. Why not do stuff beyond the edge, because anybody can do stuff. That's here. You just point a camera at it. So it seemed at the time that an issue that would become vital was the issue of climate change. And it was far enough ahead of the curve for there to have to be that second program, and people go at my throat because it wasn't a public issue at the time. And these people thought that I was deliberately fomenting revolution among the populace by bringing it up. And it seems to me that's the purpose of making documentary films. Well, except when you make, obviously, you point the camera backwards and say, here we are in the 15th century, have a look at so-and-so. But in terms of what I do, which is to deal with science and technology and its effect on society, one is always predicting, one is always trying to predict, because that's the only purpose.
Did you anticipate that there would be the tremendous negative reaction to the program?
Oh, yes. Sure. I'll risk it and somebody will go for your throat. If you sell oil and coal, the last thing you want to talk about is CO2 forcing. That's the last thing you want to talk about. And that's the people who went for my throat. I don't think they do it anymore, because the pressure now is to make coal clean, and they may well do. We are going to start pumping stuff below the North Sea soon, you know, so that we can use coal, because we've got 300 years of it, as opposed to gas, which Russia won't send to us perhaps, and oil, which will run out. In fact, the North Sea is running out. So the focus has shifted, but I don't think anybody denies anymore that the greenhouse effect is real.
Now there's some interesting reactions. Some people saying, well, we should go back to nuclear power because it produces less warming.
It does, yes. Chernobyl cloud went over us in the south of France. So I have mixed feelings about that.
A more recent undertaking that you've done is called American Connections, the Founding Fathers.
Networked.
To some degree, though, it gets away from science.
Oh, yeah, sure.
So what led you to that?
My publisher. The publisher said, I think this would be a good subject. And I said, okay. So, and there are only so many times that you can do a connective network looking at science and society and history. I mean, people start to say, oh, here he comes again. So that book moved away from the area, although it kept the connective thing. I suppose I can't avoid the connective thing because it's what I do. But I did it at the behest of the publisher, and it's had mixed reviews. I mean, because it's really only a parlor game. I know, how do you link Button Gwinnett, one of the signers, with the modern world? He was the one I never found. I mean, I found all the others. I found modern people with the same name and is strangely linked through about 20 jumps. Button Gwinnett was interesting because there isn't anybody in the modern world that I can find. You probably get 9 phone calls now saying, I'm Button Gwinnett, but I couldn't find any. And I knew that I had to get to him in the end. So I looked around desperately and I found that he had been a celebrant at a church in England, in Wolverhampton. And so I looked at that church and its history and blah, blah, blah. And I got to the fact that he had christened his little girls at that church before he left for the United States, before he left for America. And that was the way I linked him. But as I say, it's a kind of parlor game. And what I was hoping that it would do would be maybe get teachers interested in saying to kids, the founding fathers weren't the heroes that you think they were. They had feet of clay and there were some very funny things going on. And besides which, how would you like to link them to the modern world? And I don't know whether they're doing it or not, because the publisher hasn't told me whether it's selling well or not yet.
It's certainly out there on the web for anybody who wants to look for it. I guess I would look at both of these areas. First, the science one. Do you have a sense that your programs have helped inspire some young people to go into the scientific field?
Well, I get letters from people saying, science wasn't as boring as I thought it was, and now I have 3 PhDs and blah, blah, blah. Thank you. You know, that's really very gratifying.
Was that a goal that you set?
No. The BBC said, do something because you're interested in it. If they like it, good. If they don't, you'll be out of work. So, no, I didn't have any goals. I didn't want to change the world. I just did it because it was fun. And it happened to be that the audience thought it was fun too. I could say no more than that, really.
What about the reaction of historians to your work?
I wondered if you were going to say that, yes. Well, charlatan is one of the words often used. No, actually, I found that over the years, the research has led me to interact with academics. And, you know, I'm a gamekeeper turned poacher myself, which obviously doesn't help. And I've always found that the great academics will give you everything. They're like a fountain. It comes out all the time. They give it away because when they give it away, they've got plenty left. And the second-level academic will do nothing for you because if he gives you what he's got, there's nothing left. And so the great thing about the BBC is it allowed me to knock on the door of the great and to receive this benediction from them, this wonderful behavior. So I've never had any trouble with the great minds whose stuff I have stolen, as Lynn White said to me, you know, I stole it, you steal it. That's what those people are like at the top. And as for the people halfway down, I don't care. I mean, they've got their own agenda, their own chip on their own shoulder, blah, blah, blah. And they see me making money out of something that they feel they could do far better. Except that when you talk to, you know, that kind of person, they don't understand why you want to know that their particular historical study of the moldboard plow would have anything whatsoever, you know, to do with atomic fission. And they don't want to discuss it or tell you anything that will help you discuss it. So in the main, I tend not to bump into them because you can read what people say without having to experience their acerbity.
One of the more recent projects that you've been involved with is the Knowledge Web. Can you explain that?
Yeah, this is a construct that I've been playing with for a few years in my spare time. And in being in Bloomington, I'm very conscious that you have a world authority on knowledge mapping here, Kati Boerner. So I must be duly modest. I mean, mine is a teeny-weeny exercise. And it consists of a network of about 2,800 people from history, split roughly equally between science and the humanities, linked to each other as we are all linked by knowing people, by loving people, by being married to people, by working for people, by inspiring people, by fighting people. And so each one of these people has between 4 or 5, Impressionist painter, to 93, Newton, links with other people. And the name of the game is really to, guess what, follow the connections. I can only do one thing. I think most of us only can do one thing. My thing is connection. So this is a dynamic piece of software that allows you to go on this network and follow your nose. And since there are a total of about 35,000 links among these 2,800 people, it pretty much, I think, it would serve a class for a whole year, a class of 30 kids for a whole year without exhausting it, because the number of potential ways you can go through that small network is really rather large. And so that's in a nutshell what it is. It's nearly ready, not quite. It's a volunteer, non-profit, so we need help, please. www.k-web.org. If you think you have the skills to help, we are only too pleased to say thank you. We don't need money. We need people's time and talents. And, you know, we're very lucky in that people have given both. But it takes a while, especially finding graphic artists with experience in creating the kind of thing that I'd like to create. I've written specs, many pages of specs for it. And we have yet to find somebody who has the talent and the time. There are plenty of people with the talent. And unfortunately, most of the people who have lots of time don't have talent. That's why they have plenty of time. And so what we're looking for really is the ideal mix. And he or she will turn up, maybe as a result of listening to this, which is thank you for the plug.
Would this have been possible without the internet?
No. I mean, I did a little tiny bit of it with connections, but, you know, there are 10 times 20 connections in a series, and it takes 3 years. This thing has 35,000 connections, you know, so no. In a sense, I suppose, as somebody once said to me, the connections was something waiting for the internet to come along. And in that sense, I was very lucky to have, as it were, come along with that concept, and then for the internet to happen.
In a way, it's almost a perfect finale to your career to talk about the development of the World Wide Web, because the web is, in effect, a group of connections. Mm. If you were studying how the web fits in, what kinds of connections it has, where do you go with that?
Well, I would have to ask myself, what would be the most important way in which it could be used by us? And I suppose ultimately that would be political. I think I would like to believe that we are not that many decades away from the moment when we can dump this absurd 18th century so-called representative form of government in favor of something mounted on the web, mounted by the web, in which Vox Populi would really be Vox Dei, and in which, with the aid of electronic agents, every individual would be involved 186,000 times a second in every decision. And that people in government would be simply ants carrying out the wishes of the populace, which is what democracy is supposed to be and never has been. So I suppose that would be my hope for the web. And everything else is icing, fun, games. And possibly one other thing, because I believe in the connective principle, I believe that all kind of innovation and all new things happen because of the juxtaposition of ideas that were never juxtaposed together that way, and therefore one and one making three. And I suppose if the web does anything in spades, it allows one and one to make three. So put together, you know, an extrapolative ability to deal with problems and to come up with solutions and technologies that will, plus the powerful political enfranchisement of the populace at large, I would like to believe that we stand on the threshold of a golden age if we get through this particular malaise at the moment.
Let me play the skeptic on this issue. Mm. When radio first came along, this was going to be the great democratizer. We were going to get to know each other and hear each other, and we would have rational argument. And then came propaganda in World War II. Mm. Television, same thing. We were going to be able to see each other and it was going to be the great democratizer, yes. And it didn't turn out. Right. Could that happen to the web?
Yes, I mean, to a small extent, but I think the difference is one of scale. I mean, you know, the World Wide Web is vastly, incomprehensibly larger than television and radio could ever have been. It is immensely more interdependent two-way, nine-way, a billion-way. And already, I think, too many cats have been let out of too many bags. So I think ultimately the hacker will win, as opposed to the hierarchies that do not want to conspire at their own demise.
What do you think about the notion of 6 degrees of separation?
This harumph. Everybody thinks I got it from Kevin Bacon.
Let me look at a couple of other points. You have, in so much of your career, dwelt on the impact of technology. Some historians would say that's not really how it works, that technology doesn't change things, it makes them possible.
I think that any time you use a tool, your behavior in some ways is modified. And I don't think before that tool exists, that particular modification could have perhaps even been thought of. So I don't agree with that view. I mean, yes, there are certain technologies that facilitate. But the very act of facilitation means that there is a change in behavior. People are related to each other in new ways. And again, the one-on-one makes three thing, you get not an extrapolate effect, but you get an effect which is more than simply the effect of the technology, the tool being put into the hand. And, I mean, for a simple example, I suppose, over a simple example, like all mine, you know, the first Flint tool generates a hierarchical, a top-down command structure, because if you don't have that, you can't hunt. And until you have the tool, you don't hunt. So I would have said that the arrival of the first tool, Flint tool, for example, causes radical change in that sense. So I would disagree.
One of the things we haven't talked about is how new knowledge gets found or put together. Which way do you think is better, the original research perhaps funded by governments or the applied research that might be more likely to be funded by businesses for specific purposes?
I think the easy answer is a mixture of both. I do think there is a tremendous value in pure research, and that tends to be funded by governments because it doesn't immediately make money. But then it does. I mean, you know, James Dewar got laughed at because he kept a soap bubble alive for 3 years, noodling away. Cling film, the entire packaging industry comes out of that. And I think that's true of all areas of pure research. And, you know, the key thing about it is Benjamin Franklin said that wonderful thing. Somebody said, what on earth use is a hot air balloon? And he said, what use is a newborn baby? So I suppose that would be my answer.
Where do you expect to see yourself going in the future years with beyond the knowledge web?
Nowhere. I think it's somebody else's turn. I want to retire to the library and just write for the rest of my life. And I don't care if nobody reads it. I'm, you know, like the good old BBC, if you like it and they like it, that's good. If you like it and they don't like it, well, that's tough. But there are too many things to learn, you know. I mean, I still have to be able to get back to playing Recuerdos de la Alhambra, of course.
Okay, as a final question, I was going to say, you know, what would you like your epitaph to be? But that would be too short of an answer. Mm-hmm. What would you want in your eulogy?
Oh, God. He tried.
Just that short phrase?
Yeah, it'll do.
Okay. That was James Burke, our guest on Profiles today. For his final music selection, he has asked Suave Sia El Vento from Mozart's Così Fan Tutte. What's the background of this?
No background. It's just one of the most beautiful pieces of music I know.
James, thanks for visiting with us.
Thanks very much for having me.
And to our listeners, we're pleased you joined us. For WFIU, I'm Owen Johnson.
The program you have just heard was recorded in February of 2009. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Support comes from Smithville, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922, with residential and business internet, voice, and security services. Smithville, local pride, global technology. Information at smithville.net. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. Information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website, wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.